I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask out of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Baby fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989 from a boat here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Isco.
And with us today is Joe Reed from the This at Oscar Buzz podcast from Primetimer.
What's up, guys?
Hey, Joe. Thank you for joining us. Joe, yeah. I have a question.
Yes. It's got right out of the gate.
Yeah, I'm into it. All right, I'm ready.
About Primetimer.
Yes.
Is Norman Weiss real?
I honestly, he might not be. He might just be like an AI that we've sort of tapped into for. Yeah, Norman does his own sort of like little section of the site. I am very sort of like siloed into my own like features thing, but like,
yeah,
he's a machine, man. Like, I don't know if I mean that literally, but I don't know if I don't mean that literally.
Because I used to, you know, go to TV Tattle all the time.
Sure, yeah.
By Norman Weiss, and it was always so funny because it's an aggregator.
Yes.
And he does no editorial comment whatsoever, but he put his name out front. So and you know, Norman Weiss, he sounds like my grandparents' friends.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he sounds like an old school entertainment reporter. Yeah.
Yes, sure. Yes. He sounds like he's, you know, at Vista Del Mar. So yeah. all right, that's my question about Primetimer,
a site
that that I frequent and like very much. And anybody who's into television should do the same.
Yeah. So I have a dead calm question for you, Joe, because we went back and forth a little bit about films that you were going to come on for.
Yeah.
And you brought this up, which was a film that I kind of forgot existed. And I don't say that in a derogatory sense.
Sure, sure, sure.
Because I did see it when I was younger, but it kind of disappeared from my mind a little bit.
Yeah.
And when you brought it up, I was like, oh, right, of course, like, I remember that film, Nicole Kidman, right. Sam Neill, you know, Philip Noyce, all of that.
Right.
And I guess my question to you is sort of, did you see it back then? Why was this sort of one of the films that you picked? And does it hold up for you?
Yeah, I was thinking about this as I was watching yesterday. There's a very good chance that Dead Calm was the first R-rated movie I ever saw,
cool.
Which is partially why it sticks out in my head. I didn't see it, obviously, in the theater. I was... 9 when it came out in theaters. But I think around the time I was like, I couldn't have been more than like 11 or like maybe 12
sure.
years old. And I was, my parents had like gone out of state for a wedding. And so I was staying with my aunt and my grandparents. And my aunt and like the neighbors two doors down, we all like decided we're going to do a movie night. And so we went to the video store and we wanted to pick out something scary. And nobody, all we really were going off of was the Video Box, which was
a great poster.
It's a great poster with like Nicole Kidman, sort of her face like, half submerged, and the sky is very like threatening and the sea is very threatening. And
it's all like blood red.
And I'm like, my aunt was a huge Tom Cruise fan at the time. She was like big, like Cocktail and like that whole sort of like era. And so I'm sure she knew who Nicole Kidman was just from like being married to Tom Cruise, but none of us really had any idea what the movie was about. And so that was the movie that we watched. And I think because of the title, I was expecting something, and I was like kind of a scaredy cat kid anyway. So like, being my first R-rated movie, and I didn't know how scary it was going to get. So I watched a lot of the movie like behind the pillow kind of a thing. But I remember, and it was, you know, memorable for probably the first, I'm certain the first Nicole Kidman movie I ever saw, because I wouldn't have seen like Billy Bathgate or Days of Thunder or anything like that by that point.
I
bet you, I don't think I had seen Far and Away, but that was probably another movie that my aunt really loved because it was Kidman and Cruise together. But anyway.
Oh, that movie is not good.
No, we did it for this had Oscar buzz semi recently.
Of course. And
it
was, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was
their accents
good.
Although, in that movie are bonkers.
Legendarily bad. I will say, if you're looking for a movie where Tom Cruise punches a horse, that is your movie. Because he absolutely
that's a movie for
punches
you.
A horse right in the face.
That's incredible. That's really incredible. Is.
But yeah, there's a lot good, so, lot of stuff.
But the Cruise thing is interesting to bring up just real quick here, because she meets him shortly after this movie, or maybe around this movie. She turns 20 while making this movie.
Right.
Wow.
And they're then in Days of Thunder in 90 together, in 1990. So
yeah,
this is definitely when, you know, he comes into her stratosphere.
Right.
And you know, she did Days of Thunder. She has a Billy Bathgate, Far and Away, Malice, My Life, Batman Forever. To Die For is the movie when it feels like she starts to actually gain some sort of like, you know,
people start taking her seriously. Yeah.
But yeah, for the longest time, people were like, oh, she's Tom Cruise's wife. She's
100%.
Arm candy.
Yeah.
She's the reason why she's getting that. He's the reason why she's getting roles and things.
Yeah.
I saw.
She's a babe.
She's very beautiful, but weirdly, you know how they've been re-airing old SNL episodes on NBC from basically in the slot around it. Anyway, they had one with Nicole Kidman that I think was in the sort of early 90s, if I'm not mistaken, where she was hosting, and her entire monologue. The entire monologue was people asking questions about Tom Cruise from the audience.
Yeah, that tracks. That tracks like, with like, her level of
crazy.
Fame at that point.
It's crazy that she was basically not a person. She was an appendage. It was fucking nuts. It's crazy.
And you're right about To Die For. To Die For was a big one. And then Eyes Wide Shut was another big one.
Yeah.
Where
That was when, she no longer was an appendage.
Her narrative's really interesting because then, of course, when she does get the divorce from Tom Cruise, she like has this like legendarily amazing breakout couple of years where she's done like five movies and they're all great and she gives great performances and she wins an Oscar and it's just like it's the like the post-divorce glow up of all time for Hollywood.
It's also the moment too where everyone feels like, wait a second, were we like sublimating
she's
this
actually
tremendous
good.
Actor for like the past 15 years?
Yeah. Not only is she not only is she good, but she's like maybe one of our best actresses at this point. It's like
she
really
definitely is. Yeah. And but I also think that, you know, if you look at the movies that were part of this glow up, those are big swings that could have been disasters. Right?
Yeah.
Like Moulin Rouge and the others. Could have been just disasters for her.
And
I think, you know, having knocked them both out of the park, particularly Moulin Rouge, which I think showed something that I don't really think people knew she had.
I
at least not Americans didn't know she. Like, I remember that when she got cast in that, thinking, not who I would have cast.
Right.
That's
one of those movies. So go ahead, Kenny.
No, I just not. I could talk about Moulin Rouge all day. It's maybe my favorite movie. But Moulin Rouge, it wasn't just putting a movie on Nicole Kidman's back. It was putting a genre on Nicole Kidman's back.
Yes.
Right? It was the only attempt I could think of outside of Woody Allen's Everybody Says I Love You, to do a musical in that era that right. wasn't based on a Broadway musical. Right. And if that flopped or failed, or even was just good in a Dreamgirls kind of way,
right.
it would have just been a disaster. It had to be yeah. what it was for everyone not to come out of it smelling like shit, but they all came out of it smelling like a rose. So
it also, I
and there's
feel
something
like,
about sorry, a movie. Ahead. Oh, I was going to say, there's something about a movie role where within the world of the movie itself, she's such a star and she really mm-hmm. like, so that is almost like a force multiplier in that way where her personal stardom in real life enhances the role, which then sort of like circles back onto her and enhances her fame. So she really comes out of that seeming like just a giant movie star because A, she is, but also this movie really like sets that template for her.
I couldn't agree more. I you know, to sort of piggyback on that idea, I do feel like the movie and the role is so full of life and joyful and just this like it's the movie's just bounding about that you couldn't have asked for a better movie to come out mm-hmm. post divorce, post all of it, to just show that like that like I guess my point is, had she done some sort of Oscar baity, weighty, heavy movie after that, I don't necessarily know that it would have had the same impact.
Oh, I think, I mean, not to just totally be a dick, but I mean, I think that this is also an Oscar baity, heavy movie.
Sure.
I mean, she has consumption and dies. So, like,
right.
It's melodrama, but I hear you. She's the grounding force of that entire movie.
That's true.
And if it yeah. weren't for her, I do think the movie would kind of be, you know, ephemeral, candy-colored pop song bullshit. Like, I think the first half hour of that movie is like almost like trial by gumballs.
Yeah, and it's daring you to
say. Which is fine, I love about it, but it always gives me pause when I try to show someone this movie because you have yeah. to get through the first half hour in order to like be baptized into this world. But yeah. after that, like it's very, she gets raped. I mean, it's heavy stuff. And yeah. I think that to me is like that plus the others, which was such a star performance, mm-hmm. Was the, all right, we have been sleeping on Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
She is a lot more than just Tom Cruise's ex-wife. And I don't think she even got that bump off Eyes Wide Shut. Though she should have, obviously.
She should have got an Oscar nomination for that film and didn't.
Of course.
I mean, you and I obviously both love Moulin Rouge, so I'm not in any way negating or denigrating Moulin Rouge. I think that movie is a lot deeper than people think. But that first half hour is also the look at Nicole Kidman, get on board. This is fun. She's yeah. not, you know, it's not just dour sadness. Like, look at what she's capable of. And right. that's the kind of.
I know. When she shows up, it's the closest thing to a real life Jessica Rabbit.
Yes.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's unreal. But I bring all this up because Det Com obviously is very early in her career. She's yeah. still sort of figuring it out. I think she's very good in this film. I'm certainly not suggesting she's not, but she's also very green. You know what I mean? Like, you're definitely
yeah.
sort of,
oh yeah.
And that rawness, I think, actually helps and benefits the film. But so you watch this film, you know, when you were around 11 behind, you know, blankets or yes. pillows or what have you.
Right.
I was going to say, it's interesting. We don't do this that much anymore, but the word dead was yeah. used in a lot of titles right around yes. this time. And almost yes. always titles that were almost always movies that like, you shouldn't be seeing them. You shouldn't be seeing Dead Ringers. Right. You shouldn't be seeing Dead Alive. You shouldn't right. be seeing yeah. Dead yeah. Again. Like, right. you maybe shouldn't yeah. even be seeing Drop Dead Fred.
Dead Again was another movie though that I thought was a lot more of a horror movie. Like yeah, just from the poster yeah. and from the whatever, I'm just like, that's scary.
It's a good movie.
Oh yeah, it's a great movie.
I mean,
yeah. That's just not what I expected from the
Better
video
Off
box
Dead.
The title.
Better Off Dead, yeah, yeah.
Darker right. than darker than you'd expect.
Yep.
Right. So yep. I do think that even I honestly, it's not even, I'm not where Phil was, where I was like, I forgot this existed. I swear to God, I didn't know this existed. And I didn't I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like I went in and it was kind of a thrill because I didn't even look it up. I didn't even know who was in it.
Yeah.
I didn't know who directed it. I was just like, I'm just gonna put sure. it on.
Sure.
And try not to read anything about it.
Oh, that's a cool experience. Like,
that's fun. That's fun.
Yeah. Just dive into this. These, you know, vast waters of, I guess, the
Pacific.
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 Yeah. I think
Pacific,
the Australian Ocean. is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, 11-year-old Joe, where I was like, I think I'm about to watch a horror movie.
I will say this too, like, it's an unnerving first like 5-10 minutes. Like, it's pretty hurt. Like that. I mean, the
that
score
car crash scene is really, really traumatic.
And How about her being like, her eyes being pried open as they try to like wake her post in the hospital?
That hospital
was fucking scary. I was just like. Yeah. I was like, I didn't remember this movie being this unnerving and this upsetting.
Yeah.
Right out of the gate.
It's the template in my mind for that trope where, especially in horror movies, where like something incredibly traumatic happens in the first 10 minutes and then they go to like, the character goes to like escape from that. And then that escape turns into something horrific where it's like the descent is that. And, The Howling is that. I don't know if you've ever seen The Howling, mm-hmm. but like there's like this really like there's a whole attack in like a, I want to say like a porn theater or something like that that happens in the beginning. I can't remember the specifics. It was too long ago. But like Dead.com is my go-to reference point for that always because like that baby flying through the windshield is burned into my brain from like a very young age. It's so traumatic.
Yeah, that car crash is really upsetting. And I mean, the other thing too, like Philip Noyce, who's had a very successful career, you know, he went on to do, oh my God, the Tom Clancy movie that I'm drawing a blank on now.
Clear and Present Danger.
He did Patriot Games.
I think he did both of them. Yeah.
I'm looking him up right now just to quickly talk about.
He directed The Ugly Collector. He directed.
Did you do the Bone Collector? Yeah, he did the Bone Collector. So we've talked about him in 99.
We did in 99.
He did The Saint. He did that bad Saint movie.
That was a quarantine watch for me. I had never seen The Saint before. So a friend of mine got on a Netflix party and watched that. That was... Ooh.
He did Sliver.
Sliver is a famously bad movie.
Yeah.
But very representative of a genre that I love talking about, which is... early 90s sex thrillers, which
sure,
are like...
Sure.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I don't think Sliver's that bad. I think early 90s sex thrillers are always fun for me.
Yes. Correct.
I think The Saint is that bad. I think The Saint is just awful. Yes. And then I think Salt is one of the best action movies of the last 20
Salt's
years.
Salt's great. Yeah, Salt's really, really good.
Looking at his filmography, like, it is hits and misses. But like when he hits, I mean, spoiler, I really like Dead Calm. Patriot Games is great. Clear and Present Danger is fine. The Saint is bad. Bone Collector, we kind of liked. I mean, he's a solid filmmaker. And it doesn't surprise me that he's now a big pilot director. He makes a lot of television, which makes total sense.
I think the Bone Collector is the exact opposite of this movie.
Yes.
Oh, that's
and in that and this is my basic thesis for this film. The Bone Collector is I'll go the other way. I think this is a can't miss premise. And the Bone Collector is like a can't make premise. Like the Bone Collector is the opposite. So he with the Bone Collector, I feel like he did about as well as you can do
under the circumstances.
with a premise that is just brutal. You put your protagonist in a hospital bed the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really, really difficult. It works for a novel, but for a film, it's like. And then this, I think, is, you know, the premise is killer. You can't fuck this up. But I think you came pretty close, to be honest. So,
all right.
Because I think it's a good movie. But again, like, I think there are a lot of decisions I would not have made and I did not like.
I don't think the movie is perfect. And we'll get into all of that. I do think that to compare it to Bone Collector is interesting because I do think that it shows that Noyce is good at sort of constricted situations under the right circumstances. Like, I think that, to your point, Kenny, Dead Calm is the type of thing where, like, it's straight up suspense for the whole thing. You're out in the middle of nowhere. you know, just a horrible circumstance. Whereas, and Bone Collector, I mean, Denzel's very good in it. I think his performance is very strong, even if, to your point, Kenny, he's obviously immobile and can't really do very much in
It's unfair to Denzel. Yeah, it's unfair.
Bone Collector, do you know, remember how, like, after Die Hard, that, like, all the action movies were, like, Die Hard but with a twist or whatever, where, like, Speed was called Die Hard on a bus, all this kind of stuff? Bone Collector reminds me that, like, after Seven, there were so many, like, serial killer thrillers that were, like... Let's do something. And like Bone Collector is like Seven, but the guy is like stuck in his bed, like that kind of thing. And
it's interesting that Seven, and I agree that Seven's the one that really sets off the serial killer thing. And it wasn't Silence of the Lambs, which is obviously a few years previous and wins all the Academy Awards. But Seven's like the cooler one, right? Like it's the Brad Pitt one.
Seven is so easy to get your head around. Like he kills based on the seven deadly sins. That's why the joke and adaptation is so good, because it does give you this idea that any shithead can come up with some serial killer gimmick and write a movie about it.
Like trick photography, Kenny.
I think part of it is that like the thing about Seven, even though it has Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman and Gwyneth Paltrow, they're all fantastic. Sure. The star of Seven is the premise. Whereas I think with Silence of the Lambs, the copycats of that were, we're going to make a movie with a criminal behind bars. And it's like, there was that movie where like, Just Cause, do you remember that one?
Yeah, with like, Sean Connery
and Lawrence Fishburne. All we have to do is turn to a prisoner to solve this like thing. And like, that was what the copycats of Silence of the Lambs were. And Seven, it was just like, oh no, like the serial killer premise of this is like, that's the hook. So that's what we're going to copy.
And the funny thing about that too, is that like conceptually, like it's just high concept-y enough. Right? Like it's all in the execution of Seven. Yeah. In lesser hands, Seven is straight up bad, right?
Oh,
like
it's
and that's what everyone did, which is interesting. Like everyone took the takeaway from Seven was all the wrong takeaways.
Right.
It's the Bone Collector, you know, we just did an episode yesterday on Weekend at Bernie's with Danielle Savory and Beritas. And Danielle came on for the Bone Collector. And I remember when we did that episode, Kenny, which feels like another life ago. She came on and was just very passionate about The Bone Collector. And Kenny and I sort of like, this movie kind of doesn't make any sense. And it's got like the Deus Ex Machina fucking villain that kind of just sort of is dropped in your lap at the end.
Right.
Leland Orser, who,
speaking of Seven.
it's just like, you know, comes in and he's the bad
guy.
He's so good at Seven.
Great one scene performance.
Yeah, it's tremendous. It's like one of the scenes that you remember from that movie or that stands out anyway. But yeah, but the Bone Collector, it's like Philip Noyce learned nothing from Dead Calm. In a weird way. Or like just studio system stuff or whatever the case might be. But I do think that this film makes some mistakes, but I do wonder if some of it has to do with a production element. The movie took 6 months to make, Dead Calm.
Oh, interesting.
And George Miller was sort of weaponized at a certain point to direct some sequences who produced
which
the film.
Which feels like every troubled Australian production just like calls in George Miller at some point.
Every Australian director has a red George phone on his desk.
Right, exactly.
Oh, because it does. And they had it, not to jump ahead, but whatever. The original ending of the film, I think the film tested poorly, and I think that they did a reshoot. The original ending is basically that Nicole Kidman hits Billy Zane with the butt of a gun.
Right.
Potentially, it seems like maybe he's dead, maybe he's not. She chucks him onto the raft. She goes and gets Sam Neill. Credits.
You're left sort of open ended.
A little bit open ended, and the audience perhaps reasonably found that unsatisfying. So the Flair death, which is one of the best deaths of 1989, it's fucking rad.
Yeah.
With the reshoot.
Yeah. Well, that's very Fatal Attraction, right? Where Fatal Attraction was originally supposed to end differently and more ambiguously. And the studio was like, no, we need to see her get killed. And then that's so memorable when, you know, Ann Archer sort of like shooting her at the end of that movie. So that's
not
sort
just
of
her,
what
but shooting the baby inside her as well. That movie is right. Fucked.
So it's, I love that you guys Adrian both said Lyne, man. It, yeah. that it's rad. First of all, I love Adrian Lyne because that's the exact word I used. I actually used the full radical, but I actually bumped up my grade a little bit because it's the end was so radical. That being said, like, why does Sam Neill,
yes,
who is just a disaster this whole movie, fucks up so epically in every fucking way, like basically gets himself into a drowning boat while his wife is getting attacked on their boat, to have a hero moment at the end. It should have been Nicole Kidman shooting him with the fucking flare while he was attacking Sam Neill, which is also who he should be attacking anyway. So I that's the only thing I just kind of like, the only thing that I felt was like, I don't know. I think that the Sam Neill part of this movie was kind of stupid and unnecessary. And there was also a part apparently where he almost got eaten by a shark, and that would have been a lot better than him just having like the bass swim by him, which was amazing also. Yeah.
George Miller directed the scene where Sam Neill is tormented in a boat by a shark.
That's good stuff.
Like, that's a short film I want to see. But yeah, it's your point, Kenny, though, that's the same thing with, like, why does this movie begin on Sam Neill? Like, why is he...
That's what I'm getting at, yes. Yeah. And why is he first billed? The whole thing is, like, is like a bit of a mind fuck, and it just feels like they're not comfortable with... They weren't comfortable with centering this movie on the character it's actually centered on.
Right, right.
There is definitely... And I think that part of that is... I wonder if a part of that is a symptom of it's 1989 and the idea of this movie being focused on a female character's perhaps was problematic to a certain degree. I also think, too, to your point, and I agree with you 100%, Kenny, I do think that it's not that she doesn't have that she's not proactive or that she doesn't have initiative, that Ray's character doesn't have that, because she does.
Right.
But it's
definitely.
But it feels slightly less... she doesn't have as much strength as you would kind of hope her to have, like physical strength. It feels like a lot of her stuff is kind of the mind games of the situation, which isn't a bad thing either. But there's just a part of me that feels like there is this mixture of victim and hero that's going on within the Ray character that I don't think they totally land, I think is sort of where I'm coming out on it. Like, I mean, listen, she goes obviously through a whole host of horrible things in the course of this movie. Yeah. And I guess, to your point, Kenny, this movie being focused on a guy MacGyvering his way back to his wife isn't necessarily bad. It's just not necessarily executed well, I think, is sort of what you're getting at.
It wouldn't be... I agree with you. But that movie you're talking about...
Yeah.
She should be stranded, alone, and dying, and not having the far more interesting storyline happen, where she has to save herself at every moment.
Yeah, she doesn't. Yeah, the battle of wits between Ray and Huey is an interesting notion.
Yes,
I just don't know that they totally land it.
Well, and from my like 2021 perspective, I like the idea of a woman having to deal with this situation when she's not like Scarlett Johansson in the Marvel movies. She's not Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She doesn't know like martial arts or whatever. And she has to sort of like by hook or by crook figure it out. And I like that. And I also like the notion that the movie doesn't really go far enough to where she's got to like pilot this boat to save her husband, who has, as Kenny mentioned, stupidly set himself adrift on this sinking ship for no real good reason. The whole premise, I do really like this movie. I don't want to pick it out. But like, if the reason why he goes to that boat is because he's slightly suspicious of Billy Zane, why are you leaving your wife back on a boat with slightly suspicious Billy Zane? Like, that to me...
Yes,
is maybe a flaw in the concept of this movie.
Sorry, go ahead.
More than most movies we've done on this and the other podcast, I want to really go through this beat by beat because I do wonder. Like, I again, I saw this movie completely fresh.
Yeah.
So I had no expectations, you know, but you see the titles. I know Philip Noyce, and I kind of know what he's capable of. And I, you know, have certain preconceived notions about Kidman and Billy Zane and Sam Neill and all that stuff. And Australians, of course. that naturally, I love the Australians because sure. Anybody who hates the Brits as much as I hate the Brits has to love the Australians.
Has to love the Australians, sure.
Yes. But, which I do. I think the Australians are charming and wonderful. But, I don't know. I want to walk through the plot with you guys sure. And really kind of, you know, talk about it beat by beat, because there are a lot of decisions that were made in this movie that were not the obvious decisions that you'd make in a movie like this, a thriller like this. Chief among them being, like, I still don't really know if I understand who Huey was. And that's not a problem with the movie. That's probably to the movie's advantage.
Yes,
but I do think I want to like talk to you guys about what was going on with this character.
Let me just do the quick context here in terms of a synopsis. Ray Ingram, played by Nicole Kidman, and her husband John, played by Sam Neill, struggle to overcome the sudden death of their young son. In an attempt to pass through their loss, the couple take their yacht out for an extended vacation trip. While out to sea, they come across a sinking schooner and rescue the ship's sole survivor, Huey Werner, played by Billy Zane. Huey claims the crew of the ship died from food poisoning, though Ray is empathetic towards Huey. John is suspicious of his story. It's written by Terry Hayes, directed by Philip Noyce. It opened on April 7th, 1989, in sixth place behind Major League, The Dream Team, Rain Man, and Cyborg. It would go on to make $10 million on a $10 million budget. It's got 83% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 63% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars and said, the key image of Dead Calm is of two ships drawing near each other in the middle of a vast, empty, expansive ocean. The emotions generated by this shot near the beginning of the film underline everything that follows, making us acutely aware that help is not going to arrive from anywhere, that the built-in protections of civilization are irrelevant, and that the characters will have to settle their own destinies. Dead Calm generates genuine tension because the story is so simple. The performances are straightforward. This is not a gimmick film unless you count the husband's method of escaping from the sinking ship. And Kidman and Zane do generate real, palpable hatred in their scenes together. I agree with all that for the most part. In terms of the story, Kenny, which I agree with you is absolutely worth walking through beat by beat. I just wanted to sort of hit some stuff in terms of the development of the film a little bit. This was based on a novel, Dead Calm, by Charles Williams. Orson Welles was attempting to adapt this film himself, this book himself, titled The Deep in the late 60s. It was never completed. But the book was given to George Miller, Terry Hayes. They obviously adapted it. Also, Nicole Kidman apparently also learned how to steer a boat, how to actually operate a ship. Apparently she took lessons during the storm sequence near the end of the film. She's actually piloting the yacht. She looks like she is. Good for her. And one other thing. In 2012, in an interview with Mark Maron, Sam Neill expressed some discomfort over the fact that he was twice Nicole Kidman's age when they played a couple in this film, which I appreciate Sam Neill acknowledging the fact that, in terms of like the beat by beat of it, Kenny, basically the film opens with Sam Neill at a train station, it seems like, and he's taken aside by two police officers. He's taken to a hospital. There's been a car crash. His son has died. He's asked specifics about the son's death that show that this guy is military. He asked.
Yeah, he's a naval officer.
His uniform might give that away too.
Yes, it does.
I mean, in the sense of how sort of specific he is about wanting to know how long his son was alive post accident, and just sort of there's a clinical almost.
It's nasty as shit. Honestly, like it's a really really nasty opening. And as the film wore on, I did start to wonder how necessary it was.
Well, that was a question I was going to ask you guys too. I understand wanting to understand their headspace and their mental state, but I don't necessarily know that you needed it. Or if you did need it, whether or not it could have been flashbacks when we were on the boat. Because to Kenny's point, it put me, it's a very unsettling way to start your movie.
Yeah.
Which I think was the point. But then when they're on the boat, I didn't feel the weight of their son's death. I don't know if you guys did.
I think not so much feeling the weight of the son's death, but I think seeing it in the beginning makes you grateful for that moment where they're just sort of, they're on a boat and they're sort of adrift at sea. And you get why that escape would be so something that she would want and need at that point. And it doesn't last very long. Cause like this movie, like, moves really quickly. It does not sort of give a lot of, I think certain things might have been, actually been given more time. I feel like Billy Zane, you could have, like, when it's him and Kidman on the boat together, you could have maybe given them even a little bit more time to, you know, interact with each other and see if there's any kind of, like, there's an attraction there. Like, clearly make some hay of the fact that, like, Sam Neill is so much older than Nicole Kidman. And so now there's this, like, younger guy and sort of, like, remember The Edge, how, like, the whole, one of the big conflicts in The Edge where Baldwin's
Alec
just,
Baldwin,
like,
you're
Anthony too Hopkins old for her. Like, what the hell's going on? Yeah. Like, that kind of a thing.
It's Elle McPherson? Who's the woman
it
in
sure
it?
Is Elle McPherson. Yeah, absolutely. That was that, like, 3 years where, like, Elle McPherson was just, like, in, she was on Friends. She was in one of the Batman
movies.
Yeah,
they really tried to make her happen. It was,
she was in a movie where she was one of the leads. It was, like, a three-way thing.
Like, it was, like, a romantic comedy kind of a thing, right?
It wasn't threesome, but yeah. Because in Batman, she had no
Batman and Robin. Yeah, she's...
Yes, right.
Yeah.
She was just George Clooney's, you know...
Right. Was she in the girlfriend threesome that wasn't threesome? Because remember how, like, when threesome was out, there was another movie about, like...
Is it called With Friends Like These? Or A Girl Thing?
No.
If Lucy Fell?
If Lucy Fell is what I was thinking of. Not the other threesome movie, but that's the Elle McPherson movie that I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, she's only in... She's really not in... She's in Alice, Sirens, If Lucy Fell. She's in A Jane Eyre. She's in The Mirror Has Two Faces. But yeah, she's kind of
I gotta see The Mirror Has Two Faces. It's
she's in a bunch of Friends episodes, actually. I didn't know she was
yeah,
in six.
She's Joey's roommate for like a few episodes.
I love that there's an episode titled The One with the Apothecary Table.
Yes.
I love Elle McPherson. I love her presence. I really do. I think she could have been a bigger deal.
Do you remember Beautiful Girls and Michael Rapaport's one character beat is that he's like obsessed with supermodels and he's named his dog Elle McPherson. Which I will remember because that's part of Rosie O'Donnell's big like angry monologue in the middle of the movie where she's just like he named his dog Elle McPherson.
Can I just say that part of Elle McPherson's greatness is her name? It is a
great, oh yeah.
It's a killer name.
It's like Linda Evangelista. Like Linda Evangelista was a great model, but like you will never forget because like that's a phenomenal name.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's a great name.
But I think that to come back to your point, Kenny, and I agree with it, which is I don't know that this actually sets the movie's trajectory off as well as you would hope. Like it's a dramatic way to start a movie, but I don't necessarily know that it actually tees off character stuff in the way that necessarily helps the movie. But then we basically see that they're on the boat. Like it's basically you have this horrific flashback of the car crash and then they're on the boat.
She wakes up from the nightmare on the boat.
And again, I really do agree with you, Kenny, and I it's a question that I sort of is the movie has a lack of detail that I think helps it in some regards and hurts it in others, right? Like we don't really understand where this boat came from. We don't really understand like how this trip manifested. It's just sort of happened.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I've been trying to find the movie for the last couple of minutes. The movie that Nicole Kidman was in a movie, you guys remember this isn't that long ago, called Rabbit Hole.
Yeah.
That is about the same thing, but it's explicitly about, you know, the grieving process and
it's a hard movie.
Processing this kind of thing. Yeah. And that was kind of in my head in terms of a lot of ways to grieve. Never lost a 4-year-old child. I don't know. But it is a little hard for me to believe that she basically had one nightmare and then just kind of swam with her dog a lot. So,
right. And you don't get a good sense either of what their marriage is like.
No.
You know what I mean? Like until, and I'm not saying that the movie definitely needs it, but like that could have been detail that could have contributed to, especially once they're, you know, apart for the most of the majority of the movie. Mm-hmm. Are they going through troubles? Is that why they're away? How is he coping with the son's death? Is he distant? Is he sort of like officious and cold that, you know, sort of his uniform at the beginning kind of communicates that a little bit. But
in the absence of these details, and this goes to your point, Phil, I think you're just, you know, kind of left to assume that things are good between them. But to me, they're not good enough super invested in the story of them staying together. Mm-hmm. What I'm super invested in is the story of this woman not dying by the hands of Billy Zane.
You know what movie? The rape murderer. You know what movie does that better is The River Wild, where you get a really good sense of Meryl Streep and David Strathairn's marriage and why it's sort of going through problems and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're invested in the two of them sort of like, and that's another movie where they end up separated for a bunch of that movie and she's got to deal with the villains. But you end up really invested in that marriage by the end of that movie, more so than you are in something like this.
That makes me think I would have loved to have seen this film directed by Curtis Hanson.
Yeah.
But that's a really good comp too, because I would also say Kevin Bacon in that movie kind of occupies that same weird, what exactly, what kind of villain are you? Really what I'm getting at, like with Billy Zane. Like, what kind of villain are you? Because my set, and I like this about this movie a lot, but my sense is that, like, he's a reluctant villain. My sense is that, like, he would be most happy maybe with Sam Neill never coming back and maybe taking over his spot and marrying Nicole Kidman and just being a happy husband with her. Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes sense, even if it's obviously sociopathic. It makes sense that I could see Billy Zane thinking that was plausible, I think is what you're getting at, Kenny.
Well, he clearly does.
Yes.
He clearly does think, all right, there are two things I'm considering here. Mm-hmm. One is murdering this woman. The other is falling madly in love with this woman and like being with
her as my wife. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you're asking a question and I'm curious about this, your thoughts on this, Joe, as well, because we don't get much context in terms of the crimes that Huey commits.
We get tidbits.
We get video footage, which is very unsettling in its own right and that we see a slow progression of Huey's frustrations, the crew and the people on the boat.
Yeah.
And then we don't see what makes him snap, but something makes him snap. And then we see bodies. Like, that's kind of all that we know.
Right. But by that time, we've already seen him snap on Nicole Kidman, where he's like, are you saying I'm lying? Are you saying that like they weren't trying to kill me? And he's so like, clearly there's like, I mean, there's paranoia, there's possible, you know, mental illness happening there. Like he's the classic sort of off kilter villain, hair trigger, whatever. And so the movie gives us these little breadcrumbs, the stuff that we see in the videos where he's seemingly a photographer's assistant who has gone on this like boating trip to photograph models. That's sort of what it sort kind of seemed like to me from the context of that. And he keeps trying to like suggest things to the photographer who was like belittling him and putting him down. And you figure, he snapped because he felt belittled and whatever.
We've all been there.
We've all been there, man. We've all been there. One of the things, it's one of those things where I think on a logical level or like a narrative story building level, it works less well. But I think the thing that Philip Noyce does is he does these really good sort of thriller tactics that really work with me. One of them is the fact that the video only plays whenever the electricity on the boat comes back on, which is in fits and starts. So like that video is like, you don't get it all the time. It's sort of like, it reminds me of Sunshine, Danny Boyle's Sunshine in that way, where it's another movie where you board a, you know, failed vessel and people are dead and whatever. And you only get little like flashes of what happened. And I think that's a, you know, a thriller tactic that is really, really effective. I think the other good tactic is the thing where they can only communicate, Kidman and Samuel can only communicate through him clicking the receiver. That's great. I love that little touch. I think
I think that, I mean, I think that, you know, it's what you were saying earlier, Kenny, which is, you know, it's the whole, there's a primal component to this film, and there's a less is more, there's a simplicity to this film that I think really works. The problem, unfortunately, I guess to some degree, is that it does make you a little bit more focused on the turns. It makes you a little bit more focused on when there is something happening. And when those things go under a microscope in this film, it brings up questions that unfortunately,
I think, and again, I think this movie is a success and I liked watching it. I think it's a bit of a failure of adaptation where my sense is they were a little too faithful to the twists and turns in the book. I'm sure in the book, it either was a, you know, two-hander or it was told from Samuel's character's perspective because that is not cinematic in the same way. And, I think, you know, when you adapt something, you have to basically break it down to its core elements and start from scratch, which is not fun, which is like, which it feels like it's defeating. I mean, the thing about adaptations, and I've done a few, is you do think that you're cheating a little bit, right? In the beginning. Yes, you feel like, I remember, last thing I did, I'm like, they're like, what's the story? I'm like, the story, I got it. It's right here. You did it.
It's all here.
I'm like, you pretty much just follow this. And then you don't. And then it takes forever. And then, you know, and then if you're too faithful to something that's not written for the screen, it becomes bad. So I do wonder if that's what's happened a little bit here.
I also think, and this is going to maybe sound more mean than it should, but I love Sam Neill, but I'm not sure that he's right for this. There's something very distant.
Well, they're only three Australian actors, Phil. So if you can't get Mel Gibson,
it was Mel Gibson or
Russell
Sam Neill.
That's who you're working.
Or Hugh Jackman. I mean, I'll say this. I think that I like Sam Neill. I do. But there is a reserved quality to him that doesn't make him particularly action. He's not an action hero, really. And this, for the Sam Neill storyline, for John's storyline to work, you needed a really arresting actor in that role. An actor that not only worked when he's on screen by himself, but that is able to create chemistry with Nicole Kidman. And they don't, he unfortunately doesn't have either of those things. So what you're left with is, and I think you've probably felt this way, Kenny, too, which is when it cuts back, when it cuts away to Sam Neill, and, you know, he's sucking on a pipe to breathe or whatever the case might be. It's just not that interesting because, first of all, he goes there on, truthfully, on a mystery solving mission, right? What's the deal with Huey? And he never solves that. He just gets stuck on a sinking boat.
It's a big part, too. These two storylines don't really talk to each other. And there is the mechanism with that, there is a mechanism through which it could, particularly through which it could through code, and it could be really interesting. And he could find something out about Huey that could be helpful. But for the moment, Huey's on that boat. I've seen Billy Zane. If Billy Zane has to prove to me he's not a villain,
especially when he's on a boat.
When he's on a boat and he's looking very villainous, I think. I think the central kind of issue with this movie I think I'm having is I don't ultimately care about their reunification because I don't think it's going to help the character who's actually in jeopardy. Who throughout the, I mean, I guess he's in jeopardy too, but I don't care about him. But throughout the, and furthermore, like if Nicole Kidman was just a little bit smarter, she could beat him over and over. I mean, Billy Zane, there's so many opportunities where just a little bit smarter, it would be over. She knows where the one gun is. It's like that. That's, and she, the sedative was a stroke of brilliance, but You just have to wait 5 more minutes.
Yeah.
Well, you get the sense. Oh, sorry, Phil.
No, please go ahead. Please.
I was going to say, you get the sense that there were ways that they could have just added in little touches to Kidman and Neil's relationship to make some of that stuff work. Where
I agree.
Is Sam Neill going to the boat because he wants to be the hero that he couldn't be when the son died and he wasn't there? Mm-hmm. That's plausible, but we don't know that from the story. Yes. Is he doing that because he and Kidman are a little estranged and he feels like he operates better on his own? It's a possibility. Back when I wrote for Television Without Pity, we had this term that the recappers used a lot called fan wanking, which was essentially fans of a show sort of extrapolating a thing that wasn't there. It could be the truth, but like, we don't know. And it was sort of that fan sort of did a lot. And it's like, I could come up with a lot of maybe possibly ideas for this thing, but it's not there on the screen and I shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
I'm fine with doing a lot of thinking, you know, when I'm watching a movie, but like at some point the movie's got to give it to me what this dynamic is, what the story is.
But I totally agree. It kind of comes back to this, to their son dying, right? Which is that if that is the central issue that this couple is dealing with, you need to see some sort of an arc. I don't know what Nicole Kidman's, I don't know what Ray changes, how she grows, how this experience affects either of them in terms of dealing with their grief. If this is just a marriage that's on the rocks and Huey comes into it. Which it's not, right? But if it was, it was just a cleanly, this marriage is on the rocks. They decide they're going to go on a trip together to try to figure it out. And this guy comes into it. And through this horrific experience, they're brought together. Their marriage is stronger on the other side of it. I understand that. But we don't get that. And we don't get the grief either.
This is a classic, you know, this is a classic hat on a hat. where the premise, the central conceit of, you know, almost Lifeboat, right? You've seen the Hitchcock film Lifeboat. There's, you know, someone at sea comes on your boat, you know nothing about them, you're on a boat.
Yeah.
You don't need any setup for that. You don't need any setup for that. That works because anybody can put themselves in that situation. So from there, you can build what you're talking about, Phil. Marital problems, or you know, to couple who love each other who are separated, whatever it is, that stuff is easy. That's what I mean by can't miss premise. Putting the child's death in the beginning, and then, like you guys have pointed out, not using it, only serves to complicate and confuse me as a viewer and someone who wants to just enjoy a spectacular thriller setup.
Well, it's funny when. About 20 minutes into the film, I started thinking like, and I hate even saying these words, but they don't make movies like this anymore. Like they don't, right?
I love saying those words. I say it every podcast.
But like a tight mid-budget Hitchcockian thriller.
I said it on just, the Weekend at Bernie's one 10 times.
This is true. But like that idea of like a $10 billion budget movie, like this is the type of, if this movie came out today or a movie like this, it would be on. Right? Because people will be so fucking thrilled that something of this nature was made.
Yeah.
And that's
I don't think that's true.
I think that
stuff like that gets made. Shailene Woodley was in a movie that was this exact movie like 2 years ago and no one cared.
That movie was a, if I'm not mistaken, I know what movie you're talking about. It's called Adrift, I believe, or something along those lines. And it's about this couple that they basically run out of. So it's a survivalist movie, right? Where it's like they run out of supplies and they're stuck on a boat. It's not a Hitchcockian thriller. It's a survivalist movie. And I think the same thing could be said for The Shallows. Yes.
Which rules.
The Shallows.
Yeah.
I'm saying that these are different. These are survivalists. These are like, this is Gravity, but with sharks. This is like The Martian, but on a boat. Like, that's not a Hitchcockian thriller. That's not a battle of wits in terms of people, you know, mind fuckery and all that sort of stuff. That's what I'm getting at.
I think Hitchcockian movies are one of the few things that do still get made. From the why don't they make those anymore? I do think that these kind of movies get made. I think they do. I think they get made because you can make them for $5 billion. You can set them in a, you know, in tightly enclosed spot. You can get decently sized actors to
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I think that the ilk of movie that you're talking about, Kenny, and I don't disagree that there are low budget screen gems-esque situations where you have, you know, The Intruder, or you have something along those lines.
Yeah.
And those do get made. You're absolutely correct. I think that they're not made necessarily by auteurs. They're not made by people who want to sort of necessarily do something exciting with it. Like they're cash grabs. I think that Fincher, I guess maybe Panic Room falls into that category to some degree or another. That was a while ago. But like, I think we're both right. I think that more high level filmmakers could make movies like this. And instead they're kind of almost straight to video releases that tend to get put into theaters. So it's what it is. But more than anything, what I found about this film, what I thought was interesting about this film from a filmmaking perspective, I think it's a well-made film. I think it's a well-shot film. I think it's a well-scored film. Yeah. I think that, you know, fundamentally, I think Kenny and I tend to, the movies that don't work are on a script level. And I think that this is on a script level. The bumps that are in the road, it feels like, are on much more of a DNA perspective than they are on a execution level.
Yeah,
totally. I absolutely agree with that, because the things that I do love best about the movie are either acting stuff or mostly it's the directorial stuff. It's the way that,
right,
the way it moves, the way it, you know, scenes are filmed and whatever. The obviously the flare shot at the end is like, not only is it like an audacious choice, but it's like, it's shot really cool. Like with the shadow and the sail and everything like that.
Yeah,
like,
it's amazing.
It's also, go ahead.
The use of, it's not really a harpoon. What is that gun?
It's kind of a harpoon-ish thing.
That she shoots him in, the one where she accidentally, I think it's a modified harpoon or something like that. Where she kills the dog. This is a movie that kills both a baby and a dog. Like, he
kills a baby and a dog. That was rough, killing the dog.
The dog was bad.
Yeah.
But it was good. That was good. That was a good, moment, like, for the movie.
Got
a
ratchet.
And it was a surprise. I mean, you don't kill dogs in movies. So I thought that was his blood. And
the reveal
I think
of the dog was creepy too. Like, yes, the actual reveal. At one point I was like, you hear it yelp, you see the blood. I was like,
right,
I guess we're just not going to see the dog. And then they showed the dog.
And then they showed it. Yeah.
And I think that I like a movie on a boat that uses nautical means to kill people. I think that's appropriate. Yeah. And I think that harpoon gun was really cool. And I think the geography of the boat was cool. You know, I think that, The up and down part of it, like just you know, you felt like you knew where you were at all times. And it's weird because I do think this, again, I think this was like pretty well executed. I think the score was really strong too. Yeah. I just think that like it was a failure of adaptation.
It does feel very much like with some big changes, but like relatively easy changes, this movie could have been truly stellar. Like, I think that there's stuff that's like, you know, listen, I think Sam Neill's performance could be modulated a little bit more. He could just be a little bit more likable. He could be closer to Alan Grant than whatever he is doing in this, which feels more like a Tom Clancy character, like just very kind of like cold and reserved. Yeah. But I think that, you know, it's interesting. I agree with you guys. I felt very little connection between John and Ray throughout most of this film. But at the end of the film, when they're reaching out to each other, as you felt real tension. I felt real emotion in that moment.
Totally. Yeah.
So I was just like, I found myself surprised by how much I really cared that these two, and even if I knew that they were going to, obviously, but it worked.
That scene also does something that I'm always wanting action movies to do, which is he grabs her, you know, he grabs her arm and he grabs the side of the boat. And like, that's usually what most movies, that's enough. But in this one, it shows you how difficult that would be to still climb up that boat. Like, he's really working at that. And like, she's really like, there's a one point where he's sort of like trying to pull himself up her, and she's like almost mostly out of the boat.
Yeah,
like,
I know. Yeah,
that's actually how that would go down. Is like it's not over until you've got like 2 feet on the boat at that point. And
there's
like
a, there's another point in this where he does try to jump onto the boat and
he misses.
Yeah, face plant. So and we already have seen the consequences of what happens when you're kind of
when you miss
at sea.
And the
boat is moving. Like you're fucked for a while until you can find. So I thought that stuff was fantastic.
You know, it's so you're speaking of at the beginning of the movie, essentially what happens is he goes. Okay, so John is suspicious of Huey. He goes to the other boat. He discovers, or maybe does he discover the bodies? Yes, he does. He discovers the bodies at that point. Then he gets back on the rowboat. He goes back to his boat, realizes Huey's a murderer.
I don't know, because at this point, Huey had a pretty good story as to why everyone died. He said they all died from botulism. Remember?
Yes.
He said everyone got, he was on a boat with 10 people. They're all dead. Everyone, you know, got food poisoning except him. They all ate, you know, canned tuna or whatever it is. And at that point, I'm like, this doesn't prove anything. Like, they're going to be dead bodies if they died.
But I think the bodies, you can see, like, there's signs of violence there. And there's,
eventually you do see, like, the blood and stuff. But this is, they come out of the, they basically, like come pouring through when he opens some nautical door and some hatch. And they come kind of like flowing out.
It's really gross. It's really gross. They're all naked. It's all just very.
That's that's the other thing. It's like botulism doesn't do that. So
I don't know.
I don't know what the late stages of botulism poisoning are, but like maybe that's the
first. Yes,
you take everybody.
You're right. You're right about that.
But the other thing, doesn't he find out like the boat isn't sinking the way that Billy Zane said it was? Like the boat doesn't start sinking until like well later into the movie because. And I think that's the other. It's just like he knows he's lying, so like something's clearly up.
It's but to your point, the sort of the original point, Kenny, in terms of like, I thought to myself, okay, he's got to get back to the boat. And in my mind, I actually did. Again, I had seen the movie so long ago. I had this version where like Sam Neill does get back to the boat, but like Huey ties him up or some shit, and that's sort of how that whole thing plays out.
Yeah.
But then he jumps. He misses the boat. By the way, whoever the stuntman that did that. Really just like gave her. I appreciate it, but like it's amazing. And then I thought to myself, well, now what the fuck does he do? Is he on the rowboat for the rest of it? And then I was like, oh no, he must go back to the other schooner.
He just goes back to the big boat.
Which does make sense because ultimately I don't know that he has much of a choice otherwise.
Right. But
yeah, you don't realize how big a boat is until a person is trying to jump onto it.
Yeah.
And you're like,
hard to do.
Boats are big.
It's our second. Oh my God. That was not to go back to Weekend at Bernie's. Yeah, our second boat jumping movie in a row. And one of the funniest parts of Weekend at Bernie's is when they think the boat is leaving and they jump from the dock onto the boat and then they realize it's actually pulling in.
Yes.
It is a great moment. But yeah, it's so basically at that point, you know, Sam Neill's stuck on the other yacht on the other schooner, and Ray essentially has to figure out how to survive on this boat, not really knowing how mentally unstable Huey is.
How mentally unstable do we think Huey is? Because
I don't know.
Felt during the movie that, all right, don't get me wrong, murderer. Huey, we learn he's a murderer, but all we have when he shows up is he's, you know, he's this guy, this attractive guy who, you know, kind of shows up and has a story that's plausible enough. Mm-hmm. You know, Sam Neill's not really buying it. They lock him in a room.
Correct.
At that point, I'm kind of thinking, like, what exactly has Huey done to deserve this? And is he reacting to the situation he's in? Where if you were Huey and you go on a boat after being caught in another boat, and this couple immediately locks you in a room and treats you like a criminal or treats you like an animal, I was wondering if that was the story they were telling. that they kind of, you know, through their suspicion and paranoia,
right,
they kind of
this traumatized him. Guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very Dunkirk. when Cillian Murphy is it's got that, because I mean I not to make light, but yeah, I do think that I think them locking him up is a trigger for sure, Kenny. Like, I think that definitely sets him off. It does feel like his immediate energy when he's rowing manically.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Onto their boat. When he gets on the boat, he's very agitated. Like, he's immediately seems off. Like, he doesn't seem like, which I think is smart, but also like maybe it would have been better if he was, you know, a little more aw shucks and nice at first, but I guess they just want to keep it ratchet.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is, like, do we think Billy Zane went on the boat to kill or on the boat to survive?
I think to survive.
Yeah, right. I do too.
Yeah.
I do too. And then,
but I think as soon as they are suspicious of him, I think a switch in the back of his head is just like, oh, I might have to kill these people too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that once he tells them the story about the food poisoning.
Yeah.
I think he thinks that maybe he can get away with it.
Right.
Right. Like, I got away with it. He's buying it. Right. But then once John goes and they lock him up, he knows that he's going to get found out, right? Like, this is a murderer who perhaps doesn't want to get caught as well, which is part of it. I also wonder, like, there's this weird, this movie is trying to sort of have its cake and eat it too by not telling us explicitly that Huey killed these people.
Yeah.
It's trying to keep us discombobulated as to what Huey's motives are, right? Like, is he a straight up murderer? Like, we never actually, I mean, am I wrong? Like, in any of that video footage, do we see Huey kill these people?
No, but it's like, whatever. Yeah. By that point, by the time we see the rest of the video, he's already tried to kill Kidman. So, like,
he's knocked her out.
Like,
yes.
He's at least already knocked her out. So, like, we in the audience sort of like kind of know his deal, but we don't know. I think we know he's a killer enough that like we don't need to see it like happening on the video, but we don't know what flavor of a killer he is, for lack of a better term.
That's true.
Is he somebody who snapped? Is he somebody who, like, clearly I don't think he's one of these, like, he found a boat and boarded it and like methodically killed these people. It's not like, The Perfect
Jason
Getaway,
takes
the
Manhattan.
Steve Zahn movie one. Right. It's also not Jason Takes Manhattan, which does not take place in Manhattan nearly enough to deserve
mostly
that.
A boat.
But that's a whole other thing.
It's a boat story.
It's a classic boat tale. Exactly.
Yeah,
that's the other thing. It's like that boat goes from Crystal Lake, which is a lake.
It's a lake.
I love this
up
boat.
Somehow. Into New York Harbor. Like, sure. I love
geography. Flying boat,
it's fantastic.
I think.
It's great. At this point, you mentioned
the lake.
You mentioned
which is a lake.
It's Joe,
just
you
a name.
That,
it's actually a peninsula.
Hugh knocks out Ray, sails the yacht away, leaves John behind. He gets back on the other boat. John attempts to get back to Huey's ship from stop it from sinking. Ray awakens, tries to convince Huey to go back for the husband. He says no. John manages to do the radio thing that we talked about where he's clicking and he's able to do the yes or no things with the click. So she knows he's alive. She knows that the boat is not sinking at the time.
Right.
Like
it will be soon.
Yeah. It will be soon enough. Ray then tries to stall the yacht by turning off the engine and throwing the keys overboard, but the dog goes and gets the keys.
Yeah. That's
which
a,
is a fucking great moment.
Because she's like, on the one end of the boat and he's on the other, and they're both like, come here. Yeah.
And she's like, no, don't bring the keys back. Leave the keys.
Let him fall. The dog's not going to do that.
So then Huey starts the yacht back up and tries to convince Ray that they can be friends.
Right.
And they tries to, like, she accepts, and there's like this kind of trust that they're trying to convey to each other, I guess.
Well,
it's
at that point that you feel like you can see where she sort of sees that, like, oh, I can probably at some point use this to get his guard down, right? If I play along with this, if I can sort of, you know, not quite seduce him, but sort of like allow him to feel like we are, you know,
we're on
romantic,
the level.
Then it's like, that's a tactic I can use against him.
Yeah. I mean, she sees the boat. She sees John's boat on the radar. It as a blip. It's clear that like the boat's damage is going to sink within a few hours. They communicate a little bit again through the radio where it's clear that the boat's going down and he's not going to be able to rescue her. It's basically the moment when she's like, I'm by myself now. Like there's no way that this is going to go any other way. There's also, you mentioned earlier, the sound and images of the video that keep popping up based on the electricity of the original schooner. Like just the sounds, the fury of like these images and like there's
it makes
weird,
it feel like it's
blood.
A haunted ship. Like it gives you that kind of a sense.
Like a
it's
ghost
like
ship.
It's literal ghosts. You can hear them throughout the boat. Yeah, that's a very cool effect. Yeah.
Ghost Ship, not a bad movie, guys. Kind of liked Ghost Ship.
Well, I mean, an amazing beginning of a movie at the very least. Yeah. Like you talk about like a movie that kicks
Kenny's
it off.
Looking up Ghost Ship. Ghost Ship is pretty decent. I'm, you know, all of this talk of boats.
I'll watch Ghost Ship.
I think you'd like Ghost Ship. I'm now very excited for Clay Keller to do a boat screen drafts.
Me too. I saw that he was mentioning that on Twitter.
A boat one sounds good. There's lots of boat movies.
Joe, how was your best actress one?
Oh, we had a really good time. That's up now if anybody wants to.
It's on Patreon,
By the time this, you can go.
Is it Patreon or is it right?
No,
or
it's just regular. Yeah, regular.
Oh,
regular
listen to it today. Can't wait. So excited.
It's 3 hours of this had Oscar Buzz co-host Chris Feil and I talking about best actress winners of the 21st century.
It's quite an interesting batch of best
it
actresses.
It is. Yeah. And we're judging them based on as movies rather than performances, which is an interesting wrinkle to it. So yeah, we have a really good time with it.
Is Nicole one of them, if I remember correctly?
She is. She won for
the hours.
By a nose.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. so then Huey comes down, sees that Ray's crying, tries to soothe her. Basically, Ray formulates a plan that she's going to seduce him at this point.
Yeah.
So I feel like we need to talk about the rape component of this movie point. Because it really does feel like, you know, I'm not really sure what there really is to say other than the fact that he's a terrible person and this shouldn't have happened. But I just don't necessarily know that it needed to go as far as it did. I mean, maybe
I think it did.
Okay.
I think that is the defining moment of this movie. That is the game. Take this all with a grain of salt. That is the game move she is making.
Right.
And playing that out to the end.
Right.
To its logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. Really hammered home. Just the jeopardy she felt like she was in, I think.
Yeah,
I think any other way, it would have really confused further what we are to think about Billy Zane. Because at that point, he would have had to be the one to kind of back off. And if he did back off, that would have really messed with my head, to be honest.
Yeah, it's what's interesting about it is it's a little ping pongy in the fact that they make out a little bit. He tears off her clothes, but then she stalls by saying she has to go to the bathroom. Then she assembles the gun. He hears the dog bark. Then he goes to investigate, and she leaves the gun behind. She panics. She takes some cigarettes. She eases his suspicion, and that's how. And then they have sex. So there is a little bit of like.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
it almost doesn't need to go there, but she has no choice. Is ultimately she realizes that like she needs to use this card, for lack of a better way of putting it. Right. And then there's the lemonade, and she doses it with prescription sedatives, which he drinks. And then claiming to go get drunk, he heads to get the shotgun. He discovers it. There's this back and forth. There's this crazy storm. They get in a fight. Like, it's just everything's boiling at this point.
Right.
And then Huey gets the shotgun, but the sedatives kick in, and he can't fire it properly. Very opportune time for the drugs to kick in.
Yes. Oh, very much so. Yeah. But she's smart with that too, where she's just like, she knows that like what she needs to do. And there's also some great stunt work in that scene too, because there's at that point she just dives over some furniture in there, and I also
think she was hiding behind the stool and moving the stool around to play with his sedated state. That was really cool.
She was really smart.
That's like, some lo-fi shit I really like. Yeah.
She's a capable heroine in this movie. Like, I like that a lot. Yeah.
So obviously thinking a lot about boat movies as I'm watching this movie. Sure. And I do feel like this movie also felt, and this might sound silly to say, but believably on a boat. Like, I think that we see a lot of boat movies where they get very, like, I think about A Perfect Storm or White Squall or even Cape Fear near the end, where it
gets, you should be on this boat.
You really should be on the
boat. I should be on the boat.
You got a nice little Rolodex of boat films running through that end.
But they get very, very technically theatrical, right? Like cameras spinning around and water and wind and all sorts of crazy shit, it's a movie. I get it. But like, this movie doesn't want to go there. Even when it does get stormy, you could tell they shot it on a fucking boat and that they really did their work rather than just like in a tank with some special effects.
And you get a lot of reminders of like, oh, right, like, not everybody's like, you're not really steady on your feet in this kind of a setting, right? We're like little like shifts in the whatever, and like you could, you know, sort of careen off into a direction. I'm like, that was really good.
I also think that there's also subtle camera stuff that they do, like the way that you can see the sunlight in the window as it sort of moves up and down over people. So you can, that you don't necessarily need to be rocking all the time in order to feel the motion of what's going on outside. Like just little camera tricks that are very kind of subtle that also adds to the tension of the situation. But then we get to the harpoon moment that Kenny was talking about. Ray gets the harpoon. She shoots the dog accidentally. Another kind of clever trick that they do is you see the dog jump up on the door earlier in the film.
Oh, yeah.
So you do actually feel like when you hear that, you believe that like you've made that one-to-one connection.
Right.
So then she comes out, Huey tries to strangle her, and then we get a really nice reveal of the door sort of because of the motion of the ocean.
Yes.
Closing and the dog's carcass, which is gnarly and great. Then Huey passes out from the drugs. Ray ties him up. Great fucking score at this point. Really kicking in as like she's steering the boat through this like crazy storm or whatever. Huey wakes up, cuts himself free with a shard of broken mirror, as one does. After making his way to Ray, she shoots him in the shoulder with the harpoon, knocks him unconscious, throws him on the raft. And at this point, we cut back to John, and the mast of the boat has trapped him in the bowels of the boat at this point. So as it's rising with water, he's trapped. This made me think of my favorite moment from The Abyss, which we will talk about at some point.
In that film?
The fucking, I would argue top three James Cameron moments is when Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio has to drown herself.
Oh, so good.
It's fucking incredible.
Brilliant.
It's an incredible moment. And speaking of a marriage that's on the rocks that you absolutely believe.
Yeah.
Like a kind of a boat movie, I guess.
Yeah. That moment is almost too good to be believed.
Right?
Like,
right?
I completely agree with you. Yeah. That moment is almost too good to wrap your head around how it's the perfect thing in the perfect time with the perfect characters. Yes. It's excellent. I can't wait to watch that film.
It's also just like, it's her, it's the water rising, her running out of air, her saying like, I'm scared. Like, great shit. Yeah. Great shit. Not as great in Deadcom. But yeah, so because he finds a pipe and he's able to breathe. So whatever.
With a cockroach pipe.
Cockroach pipe.
One of those cockroaches.
One of those cockroaches. So then
I think I really did like this movie.
Yeah, I did too.
I think that there's a lot of like great imagery and great moments it sticks with you in a way. You know, we do so many fucking movies on our podcast.
Yeah.
And so many of them, you know.
Joe does as well.
Joe too. And Joe does really bad movies. But so many movies go in, you know, in one ear out the other, in one eye hole out the other.
Yeah.
The old eye hole.
In one iris out the other, I guess. But this really did kind of lodge itself in my brain. And I think that there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. I mean, basically, so John gets off the boat. He sets the boat on fire in the hopes that it'll signal his location to Ray.
That's a great part where it's like, great idea. You set the boat on fire. Oh no, it's sunk into the water. It's not going to last. Like, that was cool.
Yeah. I do feel like this is what's funny about this episode is that I really have gone like up and down with this movie
over
the course of it. Like, there's times where I'm just like, but what? And then other times where I'm like, that's actually really clever. Like, that is smart.
Yeah.
So the movies, anyway. So then dust sets in, Ray notices the flame, sets a course for the fire on the horizon. Basically, John just lays there on a piece of floating debris at this point and just hopes that his wife is going to find him. And then, we have this great moment, this great shot, which I mentioned, which is him and her. She's sailing up to him. He's stuck on this, basically on this piece of wood. And it's a very dynamic shot too. Like, it's just, they're both careening towards each other.
Yeah.
They lock arms. She pulls him back on. They later find the raft that Ray shoots with a flare, setting it on fire. So I guess
two flares. That's the other thing. I was like, this is not good allocation of emergency.
Flare heavy.
Like, you could have poked it with a stick or something, man. Yeah, like, I don't know.
Double tap.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've now destroyed, like, things could go bad. You've now destroyed your raft and two of your flares. I don't know, man.
It seemed like there was an easier way. I mean,
Yep.
What could you do with a near dead body in the ocean?
Right. Yeah. So they think that he's dead.
But there's that great shot, though, where they the shot goes around the boat, right? Mm-hmm. And you see the bloody handprint on the boat. Like, that's a great shot right there. Yeah.
They think he's dead, but the audience knows otherwise. Right. The next day, again, this is part of, I think, we've spoken about this on a more macro level of the film, but like, John and Ray seem to like be cool real quick after things shouldn't be.
Right.
Like, their kid died at the beginning, but they seem pretty chill.
You know what, man?
They're not reporting it to anybody. They're not calling anything in. They're just going to have brunch and they're going to be like
living in the now. That is like that. This is really some mental health shit, like mental health aspirational shit.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. You know? Exactly. Not,
yeah, like I this
he
is
had
my
time
goal
to make an origami little like figure to go with the brunch. Like,
you know what I tell you, this is what I tell you, Phil. This is why I'm not afraid of memory loss, because memories are bad.
Me wonder whether or not, like, are these the two most healthy people in the world, or are they so dead inside that they've just moved on and they're just like, whatever.
Maybe they're the ones who are dead.
Yeah, they're the dead calm ones.
They're the dead calm people.
Yeah. So I do want to point out, like, this movie takes a sharp left turn into like pulp horror at the end.
Right.
Like, 100%. It's funny. It was like a reshoot after the.
Yes. Yeah, we talked about that.
Not that
time,
I know. Not that great
test screening. Yeah.
Test screenings, but it does also seem like a fuck you.
Yes. Yes.
You stupid. You know, Philistines in the audience who, oh, you want a big flash? I'm going to give you the dead guy with a bloody hand coming back. We'll shoot him in the mouth with a flare gun. Like,
but I agree with you 100%, but I'm also just like, it's fucking rad.
No issues.
It is. It really is.
I have no issues with it.
Yeah. So even just the shot where, like, She's got the, her hair's all shampooed up and she's waiting for Samuel to come back. And yeah, you're right. It's like bloody, the bloody hands, like start like massaging her scalp. It's just, yeah,
it's so... like, and then the shampoo starts to turn red with blood. Yes. And she's just, yes. It's great. It's great.
You know what's funny about the whole thing is, like, on one hand, I am pretty confident that they're like, all right, they want something like big and gory and ridiculous. Yep. Let's give it to them. And on the other hand, like, the three of us are like, yeah, that is what we want. You're right. Yeah. That was great.
100%.
We are that base, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That. That's what I wanted. Yeah.
Like, it's great. It's also just.
Yeah. Never underestimate three guys on a podcast. Overestimate. Sorry.
I'll say this too. And you mentioned this earlier, Joe, that silhouette shot. Like, this is the thing that I think.
Yeah.
How can I put this? That I think we both, or all of us, wanted the film to be a little bit more of, which is, I agree with you, Kenny, super pulpy at the end, but also like classically kind of, I don't want to say Hitchcockian, but classically and smartly done. The blood on the side of the boat, the blood in the shampoo, the silhouette shot. Like, it's not done in a hacky, shitty way. It's done with an eye. So
it's
like
noir. It's noirish.
Yeah.
And this film is decidedly not noirish.
That's the thing, right? Which is, right? I think we all kind of wish there was more of that noirish component in it. Yeah. Because I think that, first of all, it would have gone a long way towards bolstering some of the relationship dynamics and character arcs. It just would have felt like we were just latched into something a little bit more. But it ends on a fucking great note. The last 7 to 10 minutes of this movie, or 15 minutes probably, are fucking great. Like, it's it ends great. Yep. Which is, as they say, the way you should always, if a film ends great.
Yeah. You know. That's what people remember. Yeah.
And yeah, as Kenny said, fucking Sam Neill somehow threw it, by the way, not an easy thing to do, to shoot into a guy's mouth through the sail of a boat.
Through the sail. Yeah. That's some good marksmanship right there.
And I also have to say too, this movie comes out in 89. I still don't know how they did the effect.
Yeah.
Like, it literally looks like Billy Zane swallows the flare and it blows up.
And it blows out the back of his head. Yeah.
Like, it's fucking dope.
It's a great shot. It's a really great shot.
And then also, the last shot of this movie is just John and Ray standing there like fucking badasses while his body floats away.
Like, and then it just ends. That's the other thing. It's like, movies used to just end. Like,
oh, we talk about that all the time. It's awesome.
Oh, it's the best.
Yeah. The movie's just ending is great. So we, you know, I guess. I get when Phil mentioned this on Twitter, a lot of people wrote, you know, how cool it is. Yeah, and I love a flare gun murder and I love flare. And I think every writer has probably put a flare gun murder in there. Yes. So my flare gun murder was one of my scripts. I called, you know, my cousin, the cop, who I bring up every once in a while, and asked him what would really happen if he shot someone with a flare gun. And he said, well, most likely it would bounce off the person's body.
Like, it's not meant to pierce skin or anything.
No,
like that.
It's not. It would most likely bounce off your body. So it could be the kind of thing that knocks you off something or hurts you. Or
right.
It would enter an orifice, though. Putting an orifice, having a shot at orifice, not only is like awesome and cool, but it's realistic.
It makes sense. That's what would happen. Yeah. It's great. So let's rate this, because we're going to do our top five Nicole Kidman movies, and I want to dive into those. So in 89, again, I think I saw this when I was quite young. It didn't leave much of an impression, if I'm being completely honest, clearly, because I kind of forgot it existed. So I probably would have given it like a 60 or something like that. The other day before this podcast, I really liked it. And I kind of saw past its bumps and what have you from a story perspective. I gave it a 77. And I think I'm kind of staying at a 77. Like, I still really liked it. I think it's got its issues. I don't think that it's like a perfect movie by any means. But having gone through all of this stuff, my score kind of kept like dipping and then going back up and dipping, like a boat, one might say.
Yeah.
I found calm waters and I'm at a 77. Yeah. I think that's where I'm at.
I like that.
Yeah.
What about you, Ken?
I was about to give this movie a 66, which is about what it felt like to me. And then the ending happened and I said it was so radical I had to give it a 69.
Yeah.
So I gave it a 69. Yeah. before the podcast. And I'm way too enthusiastic right now. I'm in way too good of a mood. I enjoyed talking about it way too much. I can't stay in the 60s. I'm going to bump it up to like a 73. Like, I think this is like,
it's
nice. A very easy movie to recommend to people.
For sure.
Like, this is like, you want a good, 2 hours at the movie? Yeah, you'll enjoy this. Yeah. So good flick. I'm happy you had us do this show.
Yeah, I am too. I'm glad I got a chance to revisit it.
What about where
your score?
What's your score?
People want to know.
Right. So at the time, as I said, probably first R-rated movie, definitely left an impression on me. I didn't mention, like, Billy Zane in this movie is so hot to the point where I feel bad about myself for feeling it, because he's like, he's a murderer, he's a rapist, like all this sort of thing. But it's just like, but the other thing we know about him is that he's very hot. And like, also like that classic 1980s scene where, is it Billy Zane or is it a butt double? But it doesn't matter. He's just walking away from the camera and you see his butt. The like the classic Mel Gibson and Lethal Weapon sort of shot. I feel like we had so many movies that went for that shot in the late 80s, early 90s.
We don't see as many butts nowadays, do we?
No, I talk about this a lot on my podcast.
Funny butts.
I wish,
funny
butts.
They're more funny butts these days.
More butts.
Can you please make a movie called Funny Butts?
It's Jason Segel and Jonah Hill.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's funny butts. Yeah, that's exactly who it is.
Funny butts.
At 11, 12 years old, Billy Zane in this movie certainly made an impression on me that I thought about. Probably at the time, I probably would have been like solid 90. Like, this movie's great. This movie rules. Can pick it apart a little bit more now.
Sure.
But I think the stuff that I remember being very cool back then are still very cool now. And I think for as much as, I mean, we sort of picked apart the narrative stuff and the script writing stuff, but like, I love seeing a movie like this that's directed as well as this is. So I'd probably pull into like a solid 81 or something like that. I feel like that's
like that.
I don't have your concern of having to like square this with all the other ratings that I've seen. So like, I have the freedom here, but
which is a concern.
I don't envy you having to like grade all of those movies and like against each other. That would drive me absolutely insane.
I love doing it. It's the dream of my life to rate things. And speaking of rating things, not really going to rate him, but I do want to jump on this Billy Zane thing for a second, because we didn't talk about him.
We didn't really talk him that much.
I think you're right, Joe. Obviously, he is insanely good looking in this movie. And the prevailing feeling I had watching him was how like he kind of fucked this up for himself. Like, he had all the tools and he kind of fucked it up by choosing, instead of like, you know, kind of leaning into the face and body and kind of natural kind of disposition towards charming, handsome, leading man. He kind of chose to be a snarky asshole, a smarter than you, better than thou type guy. And I think it ruined his career, because like, he is, I hate saying it too, because I kind of feel like I hate him, but he's as good looking a guy as I think it's like on film.
And I think at some point somebody was just like, we should just cast him as, you know, the bad guy, bad, like, romantic. I know he's had some like protagonist roles and whatever in his career, but it seems like when you cast Billy Zane in the 90s, you would cast him to be the bad guy. Obviously, Titanic is the biggest example of that.
Sure.
But, like, although the one that sort of runs counter to that I always think of him is in Tombstone, where he plays the
Mr. Fabian,
the theater professional who one of my, like, Tombstone's a great movie. It's like so long and has so many different subplots, and one of the subplots in that movie is that Jason Priestley is part of the bad guy gang, and he like
falls in love
with Billy Zane from afar and gets like radicalized when he gets killed or whatever. And like, it's so weird that that's a subplot in Tombstone, but like, that's an odd, that's like a non-typical Billy Zane character, but also kind of hinges on the fact that like, his face is so beautiful. Like, that's sort of half of his character in that.
If you Google
I'm looking him up. Yeah, his filmography. It's bizarre. Well,
but if you look at it, if you Google image him,
yeah.
And maybe it's because there's some side by side with him and Marlon Brando. He was going to play Marlon Brando, right. But this guy would have fucking killed in Hollywood from about 1920 to about 1970.
Sure,
he would have been the biggest fucking star. And it just didn't really work.
I do think it's interesting. He does this film in 89, obviously. He will also be in Back to the Future Part 2, which we will talk about as well at a later date. He's nominated for the Chicago Film Critics Association Award for Most Promising Actor for Dead Calm.
In this.
And then in 1990, he's in Memphis Belle, where he is also nominated for the Chicago Film Critics Association
Like Most Promising.
2 years in a row. So promising, in fact, that they gave it to him twice.
Oh, that's so weird.
You know, every once in a while, there'll be an NBA player who will win Most Improved Player and then take another leap. And they'll be like, he should win it again. Like, give it to him again.
That's amazing.
And I do feel maybe Billy Zane, maybe they're like, all right, Most Promising. All right, he fulfilled the level of promise we thought last year. But now the promise is even higher.
It's fantastic.
I don't remember who that happened to in basketball. Like maybe like Victor Oladipo or something, like had some like thing where it's like, I think he did it again.
So let's do our top five Nicole Kidman films, starting at five, and we'll go around. My number five is Jonathan Glazer's Birth. A movie that I found, I remember, created quite the controversy because of a bathtub scene. Which is interesting, I guess, insofar as I understand why it set people. Anyway, long story short, I think she's amazing in that movie. I think it's a underrated movie that more people should have seen, but got kind of swirled in this weird controversy. It also happens at a kind of an interesting time for her career wise. She's coming off of the Stepford Wives, she's kind of in a bit of the a weird part in her career. Let's just leave it at that. But that's my number five. I have Birth. What about you, Kenny? What's your number five?
My number five is and was the aforementioned Malice, which I love.
Good movie.
Yes, good movie, great performance. A little hint, I think, of what was coming in the future for her. She is the it's almost like it's almost a similar performance to Die For, except she knows exactly what she's doing at every step of the way. And this was a little bit of what she was getting cast at in the 90s, these, you know, kind of undercover femme fatales. And I really love that movie.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I need to watch it again. It's a Sorkin script, right? Or he did a rewrite on it?
Yeah. It's a Sorkin script. And if you see clips of it, I haven't seen the full thing in a long time, like over like 10 years, but like there are Sorkin lines from that like show up in other Sorkin things. It's like you can definitely tell it's a Sorkin script for sure.
What's your
he always builds his scripts out of parts from his previous scripts,
which I love, by the way. Like I love a good, like I can pick out little like Sorkin lines. Both of you guys picked movies, like the Nicole Kidman movies that I most have been eager to rewatch lately, and I just haven't. I need to see Birth again, because when I saw it initially, I don't know if I quite got it, and I feel like now as an, you know, older, I would, you know, appreciate it and sort of get it a little bit more. I've been meaning to rewatch forever, just because like it just seems amazing.
I have Malice on my HBO Max to watch list, so it's definitely something I want to watch as well. I just want to highlight one quick scene in Birth that I think is really magnificent. There's a scene where she goes to the opera, or she goes to a play with, and the camera just sits on her for it feels like 5 minutes, and as the entire host of everything that's going on in her head is wordlessly all over her face, and she's absolutely incredible in it. Anyway, what's your number five?
Yeah, my number five is To Die For, Gus Van Sant's To Die For. It was the breakthrough Kidman performance for a reason. It's one of those movies that, from today's perspective, we've seen these sort of media critiques made a lot since then, but like at the time it, I thought it was really on point about the ways in which people were starting to become famous through crime and through like sort of like media darlings because of, you know, crimes that they committed. She's really fantastic. Matt Dillon, who plays her husband, is really good. Ileana Douglas, who I think is
so good.
Matt Dillon's sister in the movie. Mm-hmm. And like, she's amazing and like really love kind it. Of like yeah. acerbic and whatever. But like Kidman obviously carries that movie, and she's a
couple of Oscar winners play her co-murderers. Yeah,
she's got some Casey Affleck.
Yeah.
And Buck Henry wrote the script. Yeah. I mean, it's higher up on, I'll talk about it when I get to it on mine, but, yeah, I think it's a, I think I actually went to see it recently. One of the last films I actually saw was that at the Alamo, back in February of 2020. And holds up great. Just tremendous. Anyway.
Yeah.
My number four is, Anthony Minghella's Cold Mountain.
Nice.
A movie that I feel like, is quintessentially Oscar baity, and had Renee won for it, it would definitely be on your podcast, Joe. But it didn't really do what everyone thought it was going to do. I think that everyone thought it was going to be.
It was the big front runner for that whole season.
Yes.
And, yeah.
And then wasn't.
Right.
Sorry, were you saying, Kenny?
No, I want to ask Joe about his podcast at the end of this. So,
okay. Right. I do think that it's a movie that I really like a lot. I think that it suffers a little bit from the Jude Law's not what we think he is. You can't put that movie on Jude Law's shoulders, unfortunately. So his storylines tend to feel a little wobblier than when the movie gets back to Nicole Kidman and Renee Zellweger, when I think it really sings. And Nicole Kidman is, I think, fantastic in it. I love, I think it's Alma's arc in that movie.
Alma, yeah.
Going from sort of this, like, you know, dolled up, you know, soon to be wife to a woman who has to sort of, you know, fend for herself. And I think it's tremendous, but yeah.
Ada. I thought it was Alma too.
I think Cold Mountain is one of Anthony Minghella's best films. He didn't make that many of them, unfortunately, but I think that's an underseen one. And I think
the scope of that movie is gorgeous. So huge. Yeah. Everybody's in that movie. I think it's my feeling on that one tends to be that it's hit and miss. And I think that's part of the Jude Law thing, is because he's sort of going on that, you know, it's loosely based. The novel was loosely based on the Odyssey. So like he's going through all these little vignettes, episodic, whatever.
Yeah.
Some are really good. The Natalie Portman interlude is really, really good.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is great in it too.
Philip Seymour Hoffman in a union suit who can't love more than that.
Yeah. You got Jack White acting in that movie, Kenny?
Yes.
Got a little white stripes action.
I know that.
Yeah.
I've listened to that
score.
Charlie Hunnam. There's just a lot.
Albino Charlie Hunnam. I forgot about that too. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
What's your number four, Kenny?
My number four is The Others, also aforementioned.
So good. Yeah.
So good. So awesome.
Yeah.
Such a great twist. You know, if it weren't for the others, I don't know if the momentum of Sixth Sense would have carried over to the horror boom we've seen for the last 20 years. I love an elevated horror film. I love when an actress like Nicole Kidman throws herself into that kind of role. I think the twist in this movie is so fucking beautiful and brilliant and devastating in all the right ways. It's beautiful to look at. It's kind of the first performance she gives that I wonder if another actress had given it or had been in that movie, if this movie would have just been ignored.
Yeah.
I think Nicole Kidman's presence in this movie elevated it above so many other horror movies that kind of get put in theaters, liked by certain groups, but ignored. But because of her, because of the twist, because of the aesthetics of it, it's, you know, Stone Cold classic.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting too, in such a weird, like, you know, Hollywood machinations way, the idea that like that film happens because Vanilla Sky is a remake of the Spanish film
Abre los ojos.
And that director directs The Others, and
right,
Cruz Wagner produces The Others.
Yes.
Yeah. but it all comes out after their divorce.
Yeah.
Like it's all just, it's great. It's just great.
That's another one. We did an episode on that one for this had Oscar buzz.
Which one?
The Others. Yeah. Because that didn't end up getting any Oscar nominations, obviously, but she was buzzed for that. She was that and Moulin Rouge. She was like, there was a big question as to whether she was going to cancel herself out because she was, campaigned for the both of them that whole year.
But that's interesting because I remember that year fairly well. And to me, maybe I was not quite as hooked in as I thought I was, but both of those movies kind of felt like outsiders to the game, right?
Yes,
they didn't seem like they were set up in such a way where people really thought they were going to get Oscar nominations. And I remember reading the Entertainment Weekly preview where Moulin Rouge was, tapped for all these awards. I couldn't believe it. I thought that was, just a movie only.
Well, up until that nomination morning, people still thought that it was going to maybe be a little bit too strange for the Academy and that it wouldn't, like, that Best Picture nomination was really in question up until that very last minute. And it ultimately did, obviously.
Whereas the Others also felt like it was outside of the Academy's purview, but that kind of performance has been nominated for the entire Oscars.
And so, I think because The Sixth Sense had been such a success only a couple of years before that.
Yes.
And that was released around the exact same time of the year, that like late August release. So there was a lot of comparisons there. And
it was also, I mean, it's funny because both of them were also just kind of box office hits, right? Like both of the Others and Moulin Rouge, both of them did quite well at the box office. The Others was a surprise. Like that was a sleeper movie, if I remember correctly. That was one of those, like, I remember it came out and I remember thinking like, okay, and then like word of mouth.
Well, don't forget, she wasn't really this enormous star until after that year.
Yeah.
Right.
So, that was really the big year for her. I'm sure we'll all talk about Moulin Rouge.
We'll talk about Moulin Rouge. What's your number four, Joe?
My number four is actually Rabbit Hole, the 2010 film Rabbit Hole, directed by John Cameron Mitchell, who was adapting from David Lindsay Abaire's play, which was, I believe, won a Tony Award for Cynthia Nixon when it was on Broadway. Like Kenny had said before, Nicole plays this sort of grieving mother. She and Aaron Eckhart are married and they've, before the movie starts, they've had a kid who dies, and Miles Teller plays the teenager who caused the car accident that killed the kid. And she and him have some really, really great scenes towards the end of that movie where they kind of, come to terms with it. And his character has sort of drawn this comic book, this like really kind of beautifully abstract kind of thing that they sort of like connect through, and she's just really fantastic in it. Diane Wiest plays her mother, and there's a scene in it where, because Diane Wiest as her mother also lost a kid, Kidman's character's brother, who was like a drug addict and he had died, and there's tension between them because Diane Wiest always wants to talk about it and Kidman doesn't. And there's a scene in there where Wiest compares grief to like carrying a brick around in your pocket that is just so well written and just impeccably delivered by Diane Wiest. It's really, she's one. Kidman gets the Oscar nomination for that. I'm kind of still puzzled by why Diane Wiest didn't get any attention for that, for supporting actress.
That feels like, I remember when that film came out, I was very excited for it. And also, I mean, fascinated by John Cameron Mitchell's career. Just fascinated by choices that he's made. He's a phenomenal actor and a phenomenal director. I remember when that film came out, and on an Oscar level, I think we can all safely say that like sometimes a movie can just be too hard to watch. Yeah. Like where the Academy is just like, this is too hard. Like I can't do this.
And it happens all the time.
It happens all the time, right? Where a film is just like unrelenting in what they're trying to show you, and the Academy just shuts off. And I think that that's one of those films.
That's very possible. Yeah.
not that it's not great. I just think it's so harrowing, and it's so, like, it's just the idea of like
the emotions that it's sort of asking you to sit in. Totally.
My number three is To Die For. I as I mentioned, saw it relatively recently. Holds up incredibly well. Cronenberg's cameo at the end is fantastic as the mafioso that kills Nicole Kidman at the end. Spoiler. It's an unbelievably funny, dark comedy that I think, you know, we've talked about, you know, Kenny and I talked about Heathers. We're going to talk about War of the Roses as well. Nice. You know, there's this kind of rarefied air of just truly great dark comedies that just nail tone. And everyone knows the right, everyone knows the movie they're in. Everyone's just absolutely killing it. And that's just one of those films for me where I just feel like, and it's actually the movie for me. And I, when we're done these five, I do want to talk about sort of like from 30,000 feet, Nicole Kidman's career, because it is bizarre and really interesting. But this is the movie for me where I realized, oh, fuck, she's really funny. Like she can be really, really funny.
Yes.
And yeah, just getting that, I think, is tremendous. But what's your three, Kenny?
My three is also To Die For. I love To Die For. I've seen it dozens of times. It's just, it was, you know, a movie that was always on and I never turned off. It spoke to me. I mean, you guys have both talked about why it's so great, but things about media, things about, you know, crimes gone bad, things about small towns like that. It just coalesced into something that I always, you know, was found appealing. And then Nicole Kidman's performance was a bit of a revelation for me too, because in my mind, I think this is pretty much who she was at the time. Cause I didn't see Malice until I was older. She was a period piece person.
Yeah.
Right. A period piece, and often a foreign period or period piece set in a foreign country. So for her to play someone so American and contemporary and bubbly and, you know, kind of sexy in a very Weather Girl kind of way was really a shock for me then, and a revelation to me now. I think she's not that I want her to make more movies like that at this point in her career. I think she's obviously, you know, found her lane and writes her, you know, own ticket, whatever she wants, but would have liked more movies like that.
I think that it's also the beginning, it feels like, of Hollywood not really sure what to do with her when it comes to comedies, right? Like the two big swings and misses are obviously Stepford Wives and Bewitched. Those are the two things where they're just like, oh, can she do this? I actually weirdly rewatched The Stepford Wives just recently. And the first bit of that movie, when it's basically kind of just skewering, doing network again, she's really good at that. The movie just goes way off the fucking rails after that. But
she could do anything. It's not her.
I know.
At some point in the early 2000s, they just, you know, recognized that she's one of the biggest actresses and most bankable people in the world. And we're going to give her those $20 million projects. And that's what they look like. They're Stepford Wives and Bewitched, and it's garbage. But I think that To Die For was 94, I think, right? And I think she was nominated for an Oscar, 95. Right, Joe?
95. She was not. That was the big thing. She got a Golden Globe.
She won the Golden Globe. She won the Golden Globe, but did not get the Oscar nomination.
So I think this was the period when Hollywood started to say, what exactly do we have here?
Yes.
You know, like because she... to this day, it's kind of surprised she was even cast in that role. But it's, what do we have here? What can we do with this? Like, this is not something, this is not a pitch we thought she had. So,
I think you really hit something there, Kenny, of this did not feel like a movie that, like, I remember when it came out. I remember seeing it in the theater with my mom, actually. I don't quite know why, but I did. I remember really liking it. But I also, to your point, Kenny, feel like Nicole Kidman's in this movie? Like, what? How did this happen?
This would have been a good Michelle Pfeiffer performance, you know?
She would have nailed
way more.
Yes,
seems way more so the kind of thing she was doing or was kind of called upon to do more often.
For sure.
You know, the innocence that Kidman brought to it was really kind of important.
Totally. What's your three, Joe?
My number three is Moulin Rouge, which I just love. It's so, I mean, at this point, it's, you know, faves on faves from, you know, this point to the top of my list. But it's so great. It's just, it's one of those movies that I can sort of turn on at any part of the movie and sort of keep watching. It's the songs are fantastic. She's such a superstar performance. That Elephant Love medley that her and McGregor does is like one of my favorite scenes in movies ever. It's just so fantastic. And she sells just like these really like crazy turns of mood in that one, from like sort of like manic comedy to obviously the singing and to melodrama. And as Kenny said earlier, she dies of consumption. Gotta love a movie. Like one of the all-time top five coughs into a napkin and you see a streak of blood kind of thing. Where that screen drafts list is, I don't know. But,
But I Moulin Rouge is my number two. So I'll talk about it here as well. It's what's amazing about that movie. You actually just said it best, but you know, spectacular, and also dies of consumption, right?
Yes.
Like that she can, that she can bounce on her feet in a manic, like, you know, crazy over cranked musical sequence and then die in Christian's arms at the end and breaks your heart. I mean, she could do anything like that. That is, I mean, it really is the movie that proves like, oh, this woman is capable of truly, this person is capable of doing absolutely anything.
Yeah.
It's the best movie ever made. It's obviously not my number two for obvious reasons.
Sure.
Could never put the best movie ever made at number two. Eyes Wide Shut is number two.
Sure.
Maybe the second best movie ever made. Don't know.
Sure.
But there's not the four stars. There's nothing bad to say about Eyes Wide Shut. We did in our first ever episode. And it's the fucking coolest. I wonder, did that get nominations? Is that qualify for your show?
Nope. It would qualify for our show. We should probably do it at some point.
So it's a 10 out of 10. It's
this had Oscar buzz.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting Oscar story, obviously, because there was a lot of expectation on it. And I mean, you guys covered it, you know, when you guys did it, and just the way that it was sort of talked about in the press and that kind of, you know, doomed it for a while. Like there was a while before it kind of got a reappraisal. And
99 was, for whatever reason, you know, we're the experts, not the right year for it. It just there's just something about the environment at that point that was not open to awarding a movie like that or a movie like, you know, Bringing Out the Dead. Or there are a lot of movies that we've done that in other years, I think, particularly, you know, years before 99 and maybe after, maybe in the 2010s would have been huge Oscar players. But it's just it was more on the culture was just more on this like flashy shit. And don't get me wrong, I fucking love the flashy shit.
Yeah.
I love being John Malkovich, and like it's an important movie to me, and I'm crazy about it. But like that was the standard bearer at that moment of time, not a movie like Eyes Wide Shut. And again, now people say it's, you know, and I would agree, one of Kubrick's best films, and it clearly is. So it's number two for me.
What's your two, Joe?
My number two is The Others, which for reasons why we talked about before, I think it's just incredibly perfectly, like Alejandro Amenábar, the director, is so good at doing the haunted house thing. Like that's a movie that's been imitated a billion times. Anytime you see a movie with, you know, an English manor and, you know, a widow or whatever, like some, you know, apparition in the corner, like they're all trying to be The Others, and totally, you know, who wouldn't want to be? It's just so good. Kidman's fantastic. The rules of that movie are really like well drawn or whatever. The thing about, you know, you can't open a door in the room without closing the other door and all the stuff with the curtains. And then the reveal that it comes to, it's really fantastic.
I need to rewatch The Others. I haven't seen it in a really long time. My number one's Eyes Wide Shut. Seems like that might be Joe's, and Moulin Rouge is your number one, obviously, Kenny.
No, Eyes Wide Shut isn't my number one. We haven't talked about
it yet. Yeah, oh, shit. So. Okay. Well, my apologies. Let me just talk about Eyes Wide Shut real quick. I don't know I'm curious. Eyes Wide Shut, we talked about it obviously in our episode. I'm not going to go into a whole thing about it. But on the Oscar side of things, I do think that film was was hurt by expectations, hurt by being released in July. This idea that they thought it was going to be some big summer blockbuster, like a very strange, at 2 hours and 40 minutes, it's like a intellectually cold, sexual sort of movie about like repression. Like it's just like why anybody thought that this thing was going to be a hit.
It just wasn't the right time. It just wasn't the right time for this movie.
I hear you. I'm not suggesting that it was. I'm speaking of whether or not this film could have found a slightly bigger audience had it not been sort of this cavalcade of rumors and magazine covers and this idea that everyone wants to see Tom and Nicole having sex when basically they make out in a mirror for 30 seconds.
Right. That's why people thought it would be a blockbuster. They were like, well, who wouldn't want to see Tom and Nicole have sex? And I'm like, I'm not sure.
A lot of people.
but clearly that didn't, wasn't the appeal of the movie.
So what's your number one, Joe?
Dying to know Joe's number one. I'll do Moulin Rouge real fast. It's my favorite movie, the best movie I've ever made. Perfect start. For a long period of my time, it was my answer for my favorite movie ever made.
Great.
I've accepted that it's actually Field of Dreams and a Dangerous Liaison.
In a twist, no one saw coming.
Love
Weekend of Bernie's kind of thing. I've accepted that Field of Dreams is my favorite movie, but Moulin Rouge, I think, is the most movie, and I mean that in the best way. I always felt like. It is everything cinema is capable of doing, and it does it all at a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Totally. Crazy about the film. All right, Joe.
What's your number one?
I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, and nothing against Eyes Wide Shut, which probably lands in the 6 to 8 range for me. I think it's a fantastic movie. Mine's The Hours. It's maybe my favorite movie. And so if podcast listeners want to, listen.
Excited for screen drafts now.
I was going to say, you want to listen to me talk about The Hours. This is your month to do it, apparently, because I'm on every podcast doing it. I just love it. I've watched it so many times. I'm such a fan of actresses the cavalcade of actresses in that movie, but like Kidman and Streep, it's maybe my favorite Meryl Streep performance ever. Julianne Moore is so good. This is sort of what I said, not to repeat myself from screen drafts too much, but like it's accumulated this reputation for being the bad kind of Oscar bait. And I think it's been done such a disservice by that. I think it tells a really, really fascinating story about women across different time periods. The way the movie connects them is, I think, very smart and very sort of intuitive in a lot of ways. And it just, every time I see it, there's some new little thing that I really love, whether it's, a costume choice or a line delivery or something. And it's a movie that's sort of spoken to me differently as I've sort of grown up, which is kind of cool. And I think it's got a lot of really interesting things about how people live their lives and who they live their lives for, which is really cool. And I just think it's incredibly well written and well acted, and I love it.
I gotta watch The Hours again because I watched it once back when it was a big Oscar player. And I remember, unfortunately, feeling like it fell into the aforementioned category of just sort of like, Oscar bait, what have you. I think Daldry's another guy as well who unfortunately kind of gets dinged a fair amount. I mean, he's made some mistakes. I think she's tremendous. I just want to say this one quick thing about her, just her career. I've always been a Nicole Kidman fan. Not always, but like certainly To Die For is when she really got her hooks in me, and I've really kind of been on the ride ever since. I love how fearless she is. It seems like she's willing to take big swings and take big, kind of weird roles. She is one of sort of the few big bona fide movie stars that's willing to do that. There's not a ton of them that are willing to use their clout to get something made, to make a birth, to make a fur, to make to make just weird
Dogville movies. Really incredible directors and really daring directors.
And I think a lot of that comes from Eyes Wide Shut. I think that was sort of that real kind of moment for her where she really went down the rabbit hole, no pun intended, Kubrick on that film. And I think that she came out on the other side of that desperately wanting to push herself. And I think that's really cool.
I think it's interesting that you guys had The Hours and Cold Mountain on your list, because I think that's that period where people started to feel like you have a prestige movie, you put Nicole Kidman in it.
Yeah.
And I do think that period of her career is looked back on as, you know, not the brightest moment in her career. But the thing about Oscar bait films is that they're often very good. So I think that I want to go back and watch both of those, because I haven't seen either one since the year they came out. And you both have piqued my interest. Joe, I wanted to ask you one last thing before we let you go.
Yes.
Have you done a 1989 film yet?
Oh, yes. We've done several, in fact, although now I'm trying to think of them off the top of my head. Give me a second to bring up
I'm very interested in what had Oscar buzz in 89 and did
not. 89, you're saying.
99, I figured. Yeah, no, I know you've done a bunch of it in 99.
We must have. So when we get into this period, this is when it gets a little tougher to sort of pinpoint the Oscar buzz narratives around it. This is sort of, we can look stuff up and whatever, but a lot of our podcast comes from our own sort of experiential, memories of these years. Was Bonfire of the Vanities 89?
No.
If only. It was 90?
It was 90, I believe.
I think that was 90. Yeah. So our only, the two oldest movies that we've ever done on the show are Bonfire of the Vanities and Nuts, which is 87. That's the Barbara Streisand, Richard Dreyfuss movie. But yes.
Sure.
Yeah. So no 89s.
Interesting.
One I wonder that we've done that might fall into this category is Always.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
I don't know if you want to take a trip to Dreyfussville, but that's the closest thing I can think of that we've done, Phil. But I'm sure there are
Ghost Dreyfuss.
Other films that were Oscar buzzy that didn't make the cut.
I mean, I'm actually going to just pull up our thing here, because I do feel like Fabulous Baker Boys did get some nominations, so obviously that doesn't apply. But I do feel like we had hold on one quick second here. I feel like, I mean, Lean on Me, he got a nomination for that, right?
Because Morgan Freeman in 89 got nominated for Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah,
of course. So yeah, so you've got Lean on Me, which is definitely up there. Maybe Kenny.
It's Jewison. So I could see that having Oscar buzz. I think that's, hey, look, I don't want to tell you your podcast, but I think a lot of this stuff starts from, there are certain directors that are always going to have a certain level of Oscar buzz associated with their projects. Yes. I think, Jewison won for In the Heat of the Night?
Yes.
So 69, 20 years ago, that seems like and another movie about, racial politics in the inner city. I could see that being something that people are like, if this turns out the right way.
I think of it, I think Jewison definitely won Best Picture for In the Heat of the Night, but I think he might have gotten
that was 67.
Nipped. That was the year Mike Nichols won director for The Graduate. So picture and director split that year. Because that was all that great Mark Harris book about that year.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll say that one movie that I feel like that we have covered that I know did get an Oscar nomination, so it doesn't count, but does feel like a movie that I'm surprised didn't get more, was Steel Magnolias.
Yes, right. That's gets the Julia nomination.
It gets the Julia nomination, which is understandable. But with that cast, that's a movie I'm surprised didn't get a Best Picture nomination. Like I'm kind of surprised that it wasn't like a big Oscar player. Yeah. But it's kind of a weird year. We're going to do an episode with Eric Anderson about the 89 Oscars. So we'll do that eventually. But looking at the nominees, looking at that year, it's a weird year. It's a little bit of an outlier year.
Yes. Although I was sort of looking because I looked up the National Board of Review top 10 for that year. Because sometimes that has some good Oscar buzz that doesn't make it. Almost everything on that list that year got a nomination of some way. Huh. It was Crimes and Misdemeanors and Glory, you know, like all the big sort of, you know, movies from that year, Born on the 4th of July and
right.
Dead Poets Society and My Left Foot, all, you know, those right. all ended up with Oscar nominations.
So. The movie I've never seen, and I mean, maybe we'll cover it on this podcast, I'm not sure, that got a bunch of nominations, is Enemies, A Love Story. I don't even know yes. what that movie is. Do you know what that movie is, Kenny? Have you ever heard of Enemies,
no.
A Love Story?
I mean,
it's a Paul Mazursky movie.
That's such a title, you know?
Yeah.
It's a good title.
It's a title that sticks in your head. You know what I mean?
Oh, like yes, that's all true.
The yeah. I don't know if it's a good title, but it's a title you don't forget.
I've just
Nina
never
Olin's
even heard of
the
it.
Oscar nomination. Yeah,
it's you got a bunch of nominations, but yeah. Anyway,
I love Joe, talking Oscars, and I love having you on the pod, Joe.
Thank you for coming
on our Patreon.
Yeah,
thank you for coming on the Patreon. Everyone should listen to your podcast.
Thank you.
It had awesome.
I'm gonna fire up that screen draft right now.
And
yes, well, buckle in because it's a long one, but yes. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Baby fish mouth! Baby fish mouth.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.